So what I wanted to bring up is basically the statement about evolution being true. So to me, it's a problematic statement to me because one, I think it's obviously right. But at the same time, I think it depends on what you mean. And I think there's a sense in where it's wrong. In my experience, Peterson, it really seems like when people are saying evolution is true, they're really talking about, I mean, the reality of living organisms' ability to adapt to an environment, based on their diet, the environment itself, right? The weather. I mean, there's other, I understand other nuances, mutations, etc. But I mean, all that stuff is very, I mean, obviously real, right? I would never deny that. And so evolution is true. But when it comes to the larger macro changes that are said to have, taken or are taken place over time, I find these are very based on a measure of faith. Maybe not entirely based, but there's a measure of faith in there. And so I guess what I'm getting at is just why are you so comfortable to say like, hey, evolution is true as in, the entire theory versus things that I think are very concrete, right? We can manipulate them, we can test them, they can be repeated, but the bigger picture, man, I just don't see how this is demonstrated to the point where we can just group them all together, Technically, they're
Sure.
both evolution, but to me, they're still different,
Sure. So if species can change over time, then why should we have to imagine that there's a limit to how much they can change? So I don't really see that there has to be like any kind of like set limit on it. But, absent of any evidence, I would agree. It's like, well, let's see like what proof we have or whatever. But and I think the fossil record, not for every single thing that's alive, but we have tons of really good examples, I think, in the fossil record of transitionary forms like whales. The one for whales is pretty good. The one for horses is pretty excellent. Birds show some pretty clear, distinct changes where they gradually lose teeth and their wing anatomy and general overall anatomy changes pretty consistently. But if species hadn't how do I want to say this? If all species don't have common ancestry at some point, like us and chimps, it's a common ancestor a few million years back. Us and dogs, it goes back a lot farther than that. But ultimately the implication for this is all life has common ancestry in the deep, deep, deep past. Well, the alternative to that would be, well, there would ha you'd have to have these clusters of organisms like the mammals, the reptiles, the birds, the bacteria, the fungi, the whatever, all have been independently created, and they've just since then radiated outward and done like the microevolutions and all that kind of stuff since then. Well, that I mean that's obviously not a scientific well, yeah, it's really not a scientific idea because the life would either have to, because no scientist would say that just out of the raw chemistry of nature, a fully fledged multi-celled organism could evolve. So we'd have to have multiple singular cell abiogenesis events that then gave rise to all the lines of organisms, and that's just so very much not parsimonious like at all. But I was gonna say something else. What the heck was it? But I had another thought there. This is kind of hard because this like goes all over the place a little bit. It's a good
Well, I
question though.
appreciate that you at least understand my what I'm saying, though. I feel like I've said this before and people are not even sure what I'm saying, but based on your response, I
I
think
remember.
you understand what I'm getting at.
So here's the other thing I remember. We know that the way organisms change, like we know the way microevolution happens, is through changes in the genetic structure, right? Well, if all life truly is related and all life truly does have common ancestry, then what we should see is hierarchies of, I don't know if hierarchy is the best word, but like these clusters of genetic relatedness between similar types of organisms, right? And we do see exactly that with us in chimpanzees. The things we're next most closely related to are like gorillas and other great apes. We're a little bit less related to other types of primates, but more related to primates than we are to anything else. And we do this with, you know, all the different kingdoms. When I started my live, I don't know if you were here, but I was talking about my palm trees, and then I said, well, palm trees aren't really trees. And
No,
people
I
in the
didn't see
comment
that.
section were like, wait, what? I was like, no, yeah, palm trees, they're not trees, but that's really because there's biologically there's really no such thing as a tree. It's just a
Okay.
bunch of cases of convergent evolution. So trees are more genetically related to grasses, and most of the stuff you buy, like in the vegetable section, like corn and anything where the if you look at a plant, any plants where the leaves, the veins in the leaves are parallel instead of being radial, those are what we
Okay.
call monocotyledons. So grass, let me just grab a blade of grass here. Grass fits that because the veins in the grass are parallel. Probably can't see them very clearly, but anyways, the veins in grass are parallel. The veins in the leaves on a palm tree do that. And then genetically we've tested it, and yeah, although these look like trees and they don't have real wood in them, but they seem woody and tree-like. Well, you test their genetics and they're not closely related to oak trees, something else we consider a tree, but they're very closely related to grass or corn or celery or that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So, your comment about microevolution, or rather just the limitations of evolution. So, or I guess you were saying rather they don't have limitations. I would like to propose the idea that maybe they do, but maybe you were thinking of something different when you said that. But so in my mind, I think through selective breeding. Sometimes it's also called divergent evolution. I mean, we breed horses to get really fast. Some people breed pigs to get really large. I would say that they do have
Interesting.
limits. And even
Yeah.
with, different type of genetic engineering tools like CRISPR, there are like even limits in what can be spliced and combined. I mean, if you want to make a horse really fast, why don't you just breed wings on it? Like to me,
Yeah.
there's got to be limits somewhere, right? And to me, at that point, we would ask, okay, when does it become too speculative to say, okay, these small changes can represent these big, larger ones we assume happen over time?
So what I meant by it doesn't have limits is there's no reason that evolution can't explain where all life on Earth came from, and there's no reason that all life couldn't have evolved from, a unicellular type of life in the past. I didn't really mean that evolution can literally do everything, because there are things that it can't do. There's a really good YouTube video by the channel's called, well, it used to be called It's Okay to Be Smart. I think it's just called Be Smart now. But he talks about what evolution can't do. So it's like the question of how come animals don't have wheels if wheels are so good for moving around and would theoretically be efficient. It's like, well, yeah, I mean there are limitations. Like wings have independently evolved in the insect kingdom, in the bird kingdom. You can kind of argue that some fish have wings. And in the mammal kingdom, right? And I'm not forgetting anything, am I? Insects, birds, and mammals. Those are the only flying animals, organisms, right? Whatever. But it doesn't happen like overnight, right? Oh, actually, there probably was a separate type of dinosaur that could fly. It had bat-like wings. It's a pretty recent discovery, so.
So technically, though, I mean, you do still, not you specifically, but I would say that evolutionists do implement sort of rapid changes, though, bigger ones that don't take that long. Correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't it called punctuated equilibrium, which is the idea that some of these changes happened, they did happen fast and drastically?
Yeah, but fast, like like 10,000 years in the grand scheme of things,
Is
in
still
a
not
world
that
that's
much.
billions of years old, is really quick. And punctuated equilibrium was pushed forward by, oh man, I just drew a huge blank. He's a paleontologist. What the heck is wrong with me? I can't
Yeah, I
remember his
was just
name,
reading about it
some people
today
say.
too, actually. His name's
But
slipping me.
what they find is, like, in the fossil record, when they look at ammonite shells, they find that you have crap loads of shells that look so incredibly similar in the same kind of rock strata, and then in rock strata above it, which represents, it's hard to know exactly how much time. So you don't see super gradual changes. I mean, they are gradual, but they imagine it like a staircase where you still are only going up like one step at a time, but it's kind of a fairly dramatic change. But we're not talking about full-blown speciation change with punctuated equilibrium. We're not talking about, like, if we were relating this to humans, we're not talking about, like, well, the brain case just gets 20% bigger in per 100,000 years, and it just gets that big all of a sudden in one generation, and then that gets to us. No, it's like it's still gradual, but you have like these long periods of stability between it, right? And because of the nature of how incredibly rare it is that anything will fossilize, punctuated equilibrium is what the evidence is going to look like those transitional fossils I was talking about earlier, like for whales. Like you can it's very it's When you look at them, it looks really clear that we're looking at transitional forms, because, like, for example, Dorudon and Basilosaurus and some of the others, like the blowhole in cetaceans is currently on top of their head, but in those they have like the really long snout, but the blowhole's like towards the tip and then towards the middle and then towards maybe like what we'd call the forehead, and then gradually it moves towards the back. So, like, that's what you would expect to find, but we don't have a million different examples where we see it move a fraction of a millimeter at a time. So that kind of looks like punctuated equilibrium in a way, but that's mostly just because we have millions of fossils, but we don't have millions of fossils of each species.
So, I don't know too much about whales. The only thing I do know is they say that the pelvic bones, or rather, they have, what are they called? Oh my gosh, give me a second, it'll come to me.
Hind legs.
Vestigial structures.
Yeah,
Yeah,
vestigial.
so let's say they have vestigial, like hind legs. But it's my understanding that those bones are used for, mating. So I'm not sure they're entirely vestigial, but honestly, that's all that I know about whales, anyways. And
So a structure can be considered vestigial and still have a function. So, like, whales today still have pelvic structures, like pelvic bones that have been severely reduced, but they don't have any leg bones anymore. I'm not aware of a single one that does. But Bacillosaurus and a few other of the like transitionary fossils for whales did have extremely diminutive hind legs. So did they use those hind legs for something? They may have used them to like clasp together during mating. But eventually that trait just completely disappeared. So the thing is, those hind legs are a they're what we call a highly derived trait, which means it's so like any trait that an organism has is a modification of that trait in a different form with a different function from the past. It's like a bat's wing is a hand that at one point its ancestors didn't use it for a flight, but gradually got modified to that. So anyways, the Bacillosaurus, its hind legs, while they may have used them like for clasping during mating or something, they weren't used for walking, but that was the function of the legs in its ancestors. So it's considered like a vestigial structure, like in that way. Not that it's literally functionless, but it doesn't have the function that it was originally for. But there are some, like there are skinks that have a skink is just a type of reptile that they there are some it might not be the skink, I'm not sure, or it may be an amphibian, but there's
I'm
one of
not
the
sure what
two
that
where
is. A skink?
A skink, it's a type of lizard. It's one of the groups of
Okay.
lizards. Like Gila monsters, those are a type of lizard. Skinks are a type of lizard.
Okay.
What are some other types of lizards? Chameleons are a type of lizard, I'm pretty sure, you know. But there's many species of chameleon. So anyways, I have a bruise on my arm. Oh, anyways, there are ones that they have legs that are so small that they don't touch the ground. And I'm not aware of any function that they have, so they're considered vestigial. But there are, you know, there are some things like the human appendix. It was considered vestigial for a long time. Now we can live without it. You can live a completely normal life without it, but it has some function in the immune system. We just don't really know exactly what it does. And some people have tried to imagine what it may have been more useful for in the past, but we don't really know.
Okay. I honestly don't know much about that, so I probably shouldn't even comment. But I think what you're saying, at least in theory, I acknowledge that makes sense, right? And obviously looking at fossils that are believed to, I mean, obviously be transitionary, then that would obviously that connects the two dots, right? So that makes sense to me. I do still wonder though, to what degree this lines up in every different type of species though. So, for example, I know you did mention the horse evolution. Now, listen, it's my understanding now, this could be wrong, but I believe it has been demonstrated to find different transitionaries or transitions of like the horse evolution in the same layers. So, you know, they'll put them in a particular order. But you can find those fossils in some layers above it and some layers under it. Would you just say that has to do with, I mean, some type of just it's not the rule, it's like an exception to the rule versus, you know, you wouldn't just say this disproves the theory, right? From my
Yeah.
idea, well, hey, if you can find that fossil in different layers, well, then that does seem kind of hard on the idea that the layers are proving a consistent horse evolution.
So I'm not 100% sure of the timeline with horses. Now, there can be overlap with those transitionary forms, but this is where it gets so squirrely and hard to understand. So, like, we know that humans, like modern humans, coexisted with Homo erectus at one point on this planet. But Homo erectus, it's not exactly considered a transitional form, but like it would be put up in diagrams of it. So we didn't evolve from Homo erectus, but Homo erectus, God, how do you say this?
You'd
We
say they had a common
coexisted.
ancestor, right?
Yeah, us and Homo erectus have a common ancestor, but Homo habilis, as like a species, probably evolved before humans, and then the species that eventually gave rise to anatomically modern humans, that population cropped up a few hundred thousand years after Homo habilis, but Homo habilis had been around for a while. So they appear earlier than us, but they keep existing, and then we exist, and then we have this short overlap. They go extinct, and we continue existing. Basically. So it's probably the
So you're
case that
saying
we
that
see
would
that with the
explain
horse
how,
evolution. Yeah.
okay, yeah, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. Okay, so that would explain then how you would find, say, a fossil that traditionally would appear in one place, just you find it in another.
Yeah, because
Okay.
there can be overlap with several things.
Okay. What would you think of polystrate fossils then? Are sometimes called polystrata fossils. So these are fossils that connect many layers, such as fossilized trees are typically, but
Yeah, like tree stumps.
I've seen even fossilized animals like whales have been fossilized straight up, which is very odd, but that connect many layers as well. So the whole idea is if these layers formed over millions of years, how would that be possible for polystrate fossils to exist? That would seem to suggest more rapid burial, right? I mean, and plus, most animals die and then decompose on the surface, right? They don't get buried, and that's how a fossil even would have to be formed. It must be buried in sediment. So obviously, the minerals in the dirt can replace with the bone and fossilization, right? So, what would you think about polystrate fossils?
So I think it can probably be a few different explanations. One would be we don't know exactly how long it takes each sedimentary layer to deposit. So, like, an animal can die, especially like a whale, it's going to die and be buried in very thick sediment. Like, we know today, like, the ocean floor, the sediment in the ocean floor in some places is a kilometer thick. And that's not rock, that's sediment. And before you get to where the like basalt ocean crust below it is.
Right.
So over time, it wouldn't be that hard to imagine that if, when you have sediment that thick, a bone placed within it after it gets compressed and crushed will have like multiple, because the sediment forms distinct layers before it becomes lithified, before it turns into solid rock. You can see that because if you just look up like what we call ocean core sampling, a lot of it is actually just sediment samples, but they have these distinct layers. So if a bone gets in there, it's not hard to imagine that it can goop between those sedimentary layers, which aren't lithified, turned to stone yet. They haven't
Yeah, I wouldn't dispute
been
that.
cemented together. And then the whole thing cements. And so this there can be a layered appearance in there, but it doesn't necessarily mean that, like, it's weird because the sediment layers do represent multiple time periods because it takes time for the sediment layers to build up, but it may lithify sort of all at once, and so it traps multiple layers, but it formed into a rock all at once, if that makes sense. And then the other thing really quickly is for like petrified trees that have been found in multiple layers. The tree, like the fossil, we have these things called inclusions, and that's more of a geo, more of an igneous rock formation thing. But if you find an inclusion, which is a mineral or a crystal or a rock embedded within another rock, then you know that the inclusion is older. So for some of these like petrified trunks, well, it could have fossilized millions of years before it got reburied in sediment. Because like today we find petrified logs like on the surface, but at any point one of those rocks or one of those petrified trunks could be reburied by a landslide or just sitting there for eons and having stuff piled up on it. And it's already a solid rock, so layers could build up around it, and then it would be an inclusion. It would be embedded within layers that are younger than it that accumulate around it over time.
Yeah, so I hear that. Okay. Are you familiar with when Mount St. Helens blew in like the 1980s?
Yeah, and there's like, I've heard this. So there are tree trunks that are buried in multiple layers, but nothing is fossilized there.
Well, right. Yeah, it hasn't fossilized, right? Because it takes time regardless. But the whole idea, right? And I noticed Science with Simon. I think I spoke to him before, nice guy. He's saying, yeah, paleontologists know about this. It's like not a problem. I don't think the problem is like the fossil itself as much as it is the model to explain it. So in when Mount St. Helens blew, right, it blew hundreds of trees into, I believe it's Spirit Lake or Angel Lake. It's one of them, some
Spirit Lake.
pseudo spiritual name. Yeah, Spirit Lake. But yeah, so the logs become waterlogged, they flip upright, they float to the bottom, and then the sediment gets buried around it. So to me, that is a working explanation for how these things happen. Does that mean that's how the ones we've discovered before got there? I mean, I guess not, right? Because we'd have to observe it to say
It could, I mean, it
conclusively that
could
happened.
be. Yeah, it could
Well,
be. Like the thing I
so that's
described
my
with the
point,
whale
though,
bone
right?
could happen with a tree.
Yeah, so in my mind, though, Peterson, what I'm thinking, though, is I'm just saying, well, if it happened rapidly and we can show a model in which this happens naturally, well, then why is it so wrong to say that it would have happened that way? Why not assume that? I mean, granted, you could say, well, hey, there's a ton of other evidence. You would rather just sort of assimilate it all and say, I mean, maybe that happened at th like. Now and then, but again, that's not the standard. You would call it like an exception to the rule versus the rule itself. In my mind, I'm just saying, hey, if it works, if it's a working model, and I'm not sitting here invoking magic or God or, the devil put the bones in the dirt or something, then I don't see why it's so unreasonable to conclude, okay, hey, it could have happened this way. And hey, as a caveat, I understand that many people do put the cart before the horse. And they say, hey, we want to prove the flood, as according to Noah in the Bible, happened without a doubt. But at the same token, I still think it's fair to say the data does make it possible. There is data to suggest this could have happened. And I would even throw in there that there are also places where you'll find hundreds of them, hundreds of fossilized trees. You'll find even hundreds of organisms, buried, crammed into these 8 foot by 8 foot blocks of stone. These are like fossil graveyards. To me, it does make more sense in light of a catastrophe that buried the animals alive, right? Versus, again, them dying on the surface and then getting buried due to some other source. Again, it doesn't make it right, but in my mind, it still makes it reasonable to conclude, right? And I don't have to invoke some mythological magic or something to do that.
Sure. I mean, like, there have been disasters. So I don't think Noah's flood, well, I don't think it happened, but I also don't think, I also don't buy into the idea that Noah's flood is a good explanation for, because if Noah's flood did happen, then that event would have been the thing that created basically every fossil on Earth. Pretty much every fossil on Earth. But these conditions we talk about with the rapid burial and the layers, well, if Noah's flood is how that happened, then that's what we should almost exclusively see. But it's kind of rare, actually, that we see it. And also, like back in the 1800s and early 1900s, paleontologists and geologists worked out the thing called the principle of fossil succession, because they had found so many millions of fossils that they saw that there was a really clear pattern. They didn't like we didn't know anything about how to actually date rocks, but they were like, look, we have all the confidence that we need that there was this era, like the eras were named in the 1800s, like the Precambrian and the Cambrian and the Ordovician and the Silurian and the Jurassic Triassic. They saw that we have so many trilobite fossils and Anomalocaris fossils and whatever else was alive during the Cambrian. And they don't co those fossils don't coexist or can be found in the same layers as any of the other kinds of fossils, like the T-Rexes, the mammoths, the whatever, that we understand this is a distinct period in time. If there was a disaster, if all life on Earth today died and was buried and lithified, then we would find the human next to the elephant, next to the calf, next to the lion. That's a biblical reference right there. Next to the whatever, right? And if millions of, or if a few thousand years ago, all the species that currently exist pretty much were alive, we should find all of them together. There was some scientist that his like famous quote is, if you want to disprove evolution, then all you need to do is find a rabbit in the Precambrian strata. That's all it would require. But it's never been done. There's some overlap with some things, but it's pretty well understood that we kind of talked about that already, so.
Yeah, so hey, I fully acknowledge that, right? You're not going to find like a trilobite fossil on the top layers, right? And I mean, certainly I would never deny that. There are other things that I would say. So for example, trilobites are said to have the most complex eyes ever produced by nature. I mean, they also live underwater, which is a different dynamic, but they're very complex eyes, and those are allegedly some of the oldest type of eyes nature would have ever produced. So I think that would be a little bit tough on it. And that's completely indirect, by the way, because that's not even addressing what you actually said. But I would point out, though, that technically we do, though, see a similar trend across the whole Earth. I mean, the entire Earth's crust is in layers, all of it. And you pointed out earlier how most of the crust is sedimentary layers. And what does that mean? Sedimentary layers were once liquid or mud, right? They were once not a solid rock. And so that, to me, that perfectly lines up. The whole Earth is covered in layers. Particles naturally sort according to their density. I mean, they're filled with millions of dead animals. Let's just say even today, the whole earth was covered by a flood, what would probably be the last animals to survive? Well, probably birds, because they can fly, right? So I mean, maybe to me, in my mind, that could be an explanation for why some animals you find on the top and others you find on the bottom. I also would think it would probably make a big difference depending on what portions of the earth were being flooded or destroyed, as well. I mean, I think that the earth is obviously busted up into plates, right? And you have these fault lines and they're spreading, that very easily could be an explanation for why there is a diversity of fossils found in different layers in different places at different times.
Sure.
That
I'm
would just
listening.
be my
I just want to
explanation.
try to show everybody the sunset because it's really pretty. But I'm listening. I don't think it's going to focus though.
It does look a
Oh, there
little
we
wide.
go.
Oh, that's better. Cool.
It doesn't really want to focus though, is the problem. Oh well. Too bad, so sad. Ah!
Well, hey, I appreciate you hearing me out on that. I have one more question for you.
Sure,
So,
I'm gonna say one thing about that and then
okay.
we can move on from it. But the whole thing about like you'd expect the birds to be like in the top and the trilobites to be on the bottom or whatever. All that is like a statistical model though. Like it just tells you it statistically you would see, you know, they would be the ones on bottom and the ones on top. But like the pattern is unbroken and no, like this the statistics working out to, oh, it was 100% perfect. According to like, you know, like in a disaster, some animal's gonna get bonked in the head with a coconut and die right away and go to the bottom and not and be in a layer where it doesn't belong, right? So that's where like it's an
Well,
argument from statistics, but I don't think that really holds up too well.